KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on the show Professor Lewis Hyde, author of the book Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. The first word there, common, is one that anyone who's listened to Hearsay Culture regularly knows is a regular topic on the show, discussion of the commons, of shared resources, discussions of and about the public domain, and how we allow, through intellectual property law and technology, the commons to exist, this shared resource, what its parameters are, what its goals are, how it can be protected, how it can be preserved, how it can grow. And in Common as Air, Lewis has written an outstanding study of the history of this idea of the commons, tying into this book not only modern technology, but a fascinating discussion, which we will get into, of the history of the commons through the writings of people like Hamilton and Adams and others. As someone that writes both on the literary side and also as a history, Professor Hyde is particularly well positioned to have this discussion, to analyze the issues of the commons from this historical perspective, but also tie it directly into the modern concerns that we have today with regard to technology and intellectual property. And so we are going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion today, again, discussing this history, and this is something that we've done on Hearsay Culture from time to time, most recently with Professor David Post of Temple, discussing his book, Jefferson's Moose, which was a direct effort to tie the writings of Jefferson to modern technological issues. And we've had these discussions with a variety of other scholars, Professor Adrian Johns from Chicago, author of The Outstanding History Piracy. And so I'm excited to have that discussion as well. But beyond that history, we're also going to touch on a number of the more salient issues that we're facing today. How do we think about the commons in terms of how we share information? How should we share information in light of the concerns that we have with regard to piracy and a variety of other issues? What the contours of those rules should be is, again, going to be part of our discussion as well. So I'm excited to have Lewis on the show today, and I appreciate his patience and flexibility, as this has been a show that we have been scheduling for quite a while through no fault of his. It has been moved, and so I'm finally very excited to have him on the show today. Professor Hyde is the author of several books, including The Gift, Imagination, and The Erotic Life of Property, This Error is a Sign of Love, and Trickster Makes This World, Mischief, Myth, and Art. He is a MacArthur Fellow and former Director of Undergraduate Creative Writing at Harvard University. He teaches in the fall at Kenyon College, and he is joining us via Skype from his office at Kenyon. At Kenyon, he is the Richard L. Thomas Professor of Creative Writing, and during the rest of the year, he lives in Cambridge, where he is a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Again, he is joining us via Skype from an office at Kenyon on October 17th. Lewis, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's start off with a question I ask most of my authors, which is the genesis of your interest in the commons and why you wrote this book.
Well, there are two background pieces. One is I came up out of college interested in and writing poetry and translating poetry. And then since then, I've always had an interest in what I think of as the public life of the imagination. That is to say, how do creative artists, poets, and all others live among us? How do we imagine what they do? How do we support them? And that really is what led me to that earlier book you mentioned called The Gift, which is a long meditation on the problem of being a creative artist in a mostly commercial society. And in a sense, that's a book about alternative economies. I argue that there's such a thing as a gift economy, and it's distinct from a trade in commodities, and it has certain limits, but also certain values. And actually, because of that book, I often get asked to talk about how we support creative artists in this country. And years ago, I gave a talk which had in it one idea, which was some people had argued maybe we should bump up the term of copyright and instead of having the monies go back to the original rights owners, put the money into a public pot, maybe a National Endowment for the Arts, and use it to support emerging artists. And well, that was a curious, interesting idea. But as I began to think about it, I noticed this was in the middle 90s that the entertainment industry was happily asking Congress to extend the term of copyright without any clear public benefit. It seemed to be that they were mostly concerned they were about to lose the early work of film and audio recording was about to pass into the public domain, and they managed to get the Congress to not only extend the term of copyright but do it retroactively. So that kind of ticked me off. It seemed a kind of power grab, a kind of enclosure of culture, and it was one of the impetuses behind this book. I began particularly to think about why it was so hard to get a discussion going. You know, that was passed unanimously by the U.S. Congress. It was hard to get anybody to think why there might be a value to the public domain, to having things have a limit on the term of copyright. So that's some of the background and some of what lay behind the beginning of this book.
Now, as someone who is not an attorney by trade, and this is a show which focuses heavily on law, though not exclusively, I'm curious to get your perspective on the lawyers who have been doing this work. And what I mean is, as someone who views this, and we're going to get into this, of course, more from a cultural perspective, and indeed from the perspective of the humanities and I think of sociology as well, how do you view the law in this area? This is a very broad question, but we can drill down on it. Is it doing the work that it should be doing?
Well, in a way, the whole book is about this topic.
Exactly. That's why I figured I'd start at the top level.
I mean, I should say at the beginning that I think copyright is a very useful tool of public policy. I am not against copyright. I think the limited term copyright is a great invention. You know, what I think of first when you ask this question actually is some of the confusion that arose around what's called the Google Book Search Settlement. And this was Google had been digitizing books, and authors and publishers went after them for copyright infringement and so forth. And the plaintiffs in this tried to have a class action, which is they got all the U.S. authors who didn't opt out to be part of the class and so forth. But one interesting wrinkle in this was there were many U.S. authors who didn't feel that they were adequately represented by the class. And a good example is Pamela Samuelson in Berkeley wrote a complaint about, okay, we're in the class, but actually academic authors are not well represented because our concerns when we write and publish are different from trade book concerns. So the point here is that as useful as the law is, it tends to be a little Procrustean. It tends to try to fit everything into one map. And in this particular case, academic authors are, first of all, there isn't any money in most academic publishing. And what there is reputation and status and conversation. And so academic authors really care mostly about having their work get out there and circulate. So, you know, copyright law isn't as useful or as, you know, the concerns are different. So, again, I support copyright law, but I also think it's you have to begin to take it on a case basis about how well it works to do the things it's meant to do.
Now, I think with regard to the title, Common as Air, and I should note that Common as Air is coming out in paperback form on October 25th. The commons we understand, and although I'll ask for your definition of that in a moment, but common as air is an interesting reference. And then, of course, you have a subtitle as well. But what do you mean by common as air?
So this is a very old metaphor, and it arises from the fact that ideas are easy to share. That if you and I have, if I have an idea and I give it to you, this is the famous statement, I don't lose my idea. You and I both have it. And so that's what economists call non-rivalrous. If I have a sandwich and you take it from me, that I become your rival. I would rather have my sandwich. But ideas are non-rivalrous, and they also are what economists call non-excludable. You know, once the idea of the Pythagorean theorem is out in the world, it's hard to keep some people out of it and other people in. But to go back to the metaphor, so this is very old understanding. I mean, it probably goes back to the beginning of human consciousness. But I have a whole list of places where the analogy is made saying that art and ideas, particularly these incorporeal ones that are easy to share, are like water, like air. I'll give you a couple of them quickly. There's a wonderful medieval allegory called Piers the Plowman. And at one point in that book, a speaker says that human intelligence is like water, air, and fire. It cannot be bought and sold. These four things the Father in heaven made to be shared on earth in common. But this then gets picked up in the 18th century as printing begins to rise in Europe. There's a great debate over whether actually there can be property in a printed thing. And the reason is that property is often thought of as a thing from which you can exclude other people. So the right to exclude is sometimes taken to be the key piece of a property right. But if you have things that are non-excludable, then logically they shouldn't even be property. And so you find pamphlets being written in the 18th century. I'll quote one. Here's an 18th century pamphlet. A guy says, "The copies of ancient authors are no more susceptible of property than the element of air and water, which are for the common benefit of mankind." So this is a very old idea, and it gets picked up, as many of your listeners may know, by Thomas Jefferson, who says that nature made ideas, quote, "like the air in which we have our physical being, incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation." And it also gets picked up a little bit in the law. There's the famous dissent of Justice Brandeis's, in which he says the general rule of law is that these noble productions of humankind, after voluntary communication to others, are free as the air to common use. So I'm picking up on an old idea and happily standing on the shoulders of these earlier giants.
And it does tie in, I think, directly with your subtitle, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. And again, I think for purposes of our listeners, I mean, art and ownership is something we focus on. Revolution, we don't talk about, at least in we don't use that word as much. The meaning of revolution in the context of the discussion we're going to be having it in common is there.
Well, it comes out of the background, as I said, as printing began to rise in Europe, particularly in the 18th century, and I again then focus particularly on what happens in England. The background fact was that the crown, the king in England, typically controlled commerce and managed many of his affiliations by giving exclusive monopoly privileges to people. Not just around printing, but you could be the only guy in London who gets to import silk, or the only person who's allowed to do glass blowing or something like this. But particularly there were printing monopolies. And these were crown monopolies given to certain printers, and it was a wonderful way to control the press, for one thing. You could make sure that people printed the things you wanted because you gave them the privilege, and if they misbehaved, you take it away from them. So the fact is that one of the earliest debates between the Parliament in England and the King was over who gets to control the monopolies and who gets to control, therefore, printing. And the struggle ends partly with the invention of copyright, which takes the monopoly privilege away from the crown and allows, by statute, people to have a short-term privilege in this regard. But the way my book is set up, I spend most of my time thinking about how the revolutionaries who set this country up thought about these matters. So this is Thomas Jefferson and also Benjamin Franklin and John Adams and Madison. And they had inherited this tradition. They thought of the ownership of art and ideas as being dangerous, because when you give exclusive monopoly privileges to people, they tend to control discourse. And if you want to have a self-governing nation where people can talk to each other about politics, or if you want to have a creative community where people can talk to each other, for example, about scientific ideas, then you need very low barriers to knowledge and to the circulation of ideas. So one piece of the revolution in this country was to insist that ideas should be common as air.
We're chatting with Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon, author of the book Common as Air on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Lewis, with regard to this idea that in the book that you have of cultural property, and again, this discussion, I think, needs to have some of these definitions. What do you mean by cultural property and the cultural commons as opposed to the commons more generally?
Well, so let's say that any particular thing, whether it's a house or a poem, that is something physical or something intangible, any particular thing becomes property when we describe it in terms of the rights that we have in it. And we often begin with the right to exclude. So I partly know that I own my house because I can keep people out of it. I have a key and you can't come in without my permission. But, of course, there are many other rights that we can think of in regard to property. Again, with a house, you know, I can not only keep you out, but I can sell it, I can lease it, I can paint it, I can, you know, there's a menu of there's a bundle of property rights that make it property. And I should say, by the way, that there's probably never anything that's completely exclusive property. I mean, even if I own a house in most towns, I'm not allowed to set up a, you know, meat rendering plant or lease it out to somebody who wants to have a hog farm. You know, there are constraints on all, almost all property rights. But when you talk about cultural property, you begin the same way. You should think, well, okay, I've written a novel, and what are the rights I have in it, and what are the rights I don't have in it? And so cultural property is a particular subset of property, and copyright is one of the main ways that we articulate the property rights that belong to these properties.
With regard to the idea of intellectual property, and again, before we get into some of the details of the history, I thought it was interesting. You begin the book with a discussion of that phrase, and questioning ultimately whether the term intellectual property fairly reflects the creative process and, as you put them, the faculties and mind states that deal with creativity. And to quote your book, the second paragraph on page 5, you say there is intellect, of course, but also imagination, intuition, sagacity, persistence, prudence, fantasy, lust, humor, sympathy, serendipity, will, prayer, grief, courage, visual acuity, ambition, guesswork, mother wit, memory, delight, vitality, venality, kindness, generosity, fortitude, fear, awe, compassion, surrender, sincerity, humility, and the ability to integrate diametrically opposed states of mind into harmonious wholes. We would need quite a few new categories to fully map this territory. Dream property, courage property, grief property, and even if we have that list, only half the problem would be addressed. And I think that's a fascinating list, but it also suggests that there, as you talk about in a book, there is something called the commons of the mind. But as I began the show, I asked you, it doesn't appear that law, and certainly intellectual property, captures even some of those incentives and those facilities, faculties, as you call them. Does it not?
No, it doesn't, of course. And I mean, even more particularly, you know, the term intellectual property covers a range of things. I know you're interested in trademark and trade secrecy. Those are topics that get put under this umbrella, and copyright and patent are lumped together, and these are actually very different regimes. And yeah, exactly. It's one way I think about this is a sort of crowding out, that if you think only of your poem as something which came entirely from you and from your intellect, and now you can own it because the statute gives you a property right, that erases or renders invisible much of the rest of what went into the creation and how one relates to it, both as the creator and as an audience later down the line.
with regard to this list, and obviously we could spend days going through the meaning of this list, but I'll ask a broader question before we turn to some of that history. You use this phrase "commons of the mind," and while intellectual property is designed to go after that property which derives from the ingenuity of human beings. The law doesn't capture this well. How does the commons of the mind tie in with your critique of intellectual property law?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that part of the argument of the book is that almost all creative work has in the background an additive or cumulative property that anything that's made is not made in a vacuum. Nobody goes absolutely alone into the workshop and creates something. All of us work with an inherited tradition and with people who are teachers and with people who came before. And so there's a puzzle about how much of what you make you can then call your own. And again, I'm not against calling creations one's own, but the fact that most creations arise out of sort of a much wider self than the self. And what intellectual property law does often is to constitute individuality as a kind of social norm, whereas in fact, almost all creativity arises out of something more capacious than that. One thing I got onto late in the book is our word individual actually has a corollary opposite term, which is dividual. This term comes up now some in anthropology, but to think of yourself individually is to think of yourself as constituted by all the people around you, that I know who I am because of my family, because of who my parents were, because of my children, because of my church, because of the community of poets who mattered to me. All of these things are part of what makes me a individual person, a person made up of many, many, many parts. And if all of those things disappeared, I would disappear. So, I mean, it comes up in anthropology because apparently anthropologists go into some communities and they can't find individuals. What they can find are people who know themselves because they belong to a social situation. And would disappear, they feel, if all that surrounded them were taken away. So, you know, this is one of the puzzles of cultural property, that to what degree do our protocols around cultural property erase the individual self and make us have to behave as individual selves?
And do you think, while the criteria that you define and how you think about the individual is something which has a heavy philosophical base, what you're saying sounds like a lot of what intellectual property law is designed to attempt to emulate, to not operate in a vacuum, but to attempt to incentivize through actual understanding of what the inventive process is like. However, having said all that, the law doesn't necessarily achieve that end. Do you think that this understanding, the understanding of the to use the word individual, is understood, if not in the law, then by those that are thinking about, writing about, and attempting to change it? So I guess my question is, what do you see as the current state of the efforts to address the commons as a concern by policymakers, by thinkers, and ultimately by those that will have that impact?
Well, you know, we have a great divide around this because I think the people who are thinking most seriously about it, would not find my position strange. In fact, many of them have been my teachers. I'm thinking of people like Lawrence Lessig or Yochai Benkler or Jamie Boyle. And yet on the other side, we have really the content industries, people whose stream of income depends on property law, intellectual property law constituted the way it is. And so I guess, and then we have the problem of how policy gets made in this country, you know, Lawrence Lessig brought a suit against the retroactive copyright term extension that the Congress passed in the 1990s, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And I actually sat in the Supreme Court rooms as they argued this, and I remember Sandra Day O'Connor saying something to Lessig like, "Well, Mr. Lessig, this may be a very stupid law, but I'm not sure it's unconstitutional," which sadly appears to be the case.
Right.
But I'm telling this story partly because the fruit of this was that Lessig ended up feeling that even when everybody who thinks seriously about a question like this agrees that it makes no sense to try to incentivize creativity by giving retroactive extensions of copyright, when everybody agrees, who thinks about it, that this is a good idea, nonetheless, it's very hard to get the Congress to act on the sensible ideas. And Lessig has a longer list of sensible ideas which can't get through Congress, having to do with things like food policy and so forth. And so Lessig has actually turned his attentions to trying to get the money out of the way congressional races are funded. And so, again, the point is, in a way, there are two camps around the thinking on this, and one camp, which cares about the money stream, is happy with the way things are going and would also like to increase enclosure. They would like to continue to take things out of the public domain and make them private properties. And the other camp really is in accord with the founders of this nation, who feel that giving property rights in creative things is a very useful thing, but it should be limited.
We're chatting with Professor Lewis Hyde, author of The Book Common is Air, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to focus on KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture. So Lewis, let's turn a bit to this history, and I think the you know perspective that you've offered, and certainly Lessig's work, and not just in Eldred, but also in the Golan case, which was just argued a few weeks ago in front of the Supreme Court, dealing with the restoration of works to copyright protection from the public domain, all tie into this broader concern, and one that Lessig, for when I was working for him as a fellow, was starting to focus on, and now he has focused his full attention, it appears, on attempting to reform how money influences policymaking. There is a bit of a history, certainly, regarding this idea of intellectual freedom, which I think is at least indirectly related to the problems we have today. And you discuss in your book a fascinating letter written by John Adams in 1765. Perhaps you could talk a bit about that letter and how you interpret it for today's concerns regarding IP rights.
Yeah, so this is, again, 1765. The United States doesn't exist, and many people haven't even imagined it yet. Massachusetts is a colony of the England. And the background is that there had been a war, the French and Indian War, and the English had spent a lot of money on this, and they wanted to raise some money from the colonies to pay for it. But their idea of how to do that was to enact a Stamp Act, which put a tax on paper. And not just, newspapers, but basically everything else that could be put on paper, including, for example, letters of indenture or certificates of if you graduated from a college or a high school. Everything was taxed. There was a tax on paper. So the very first political essay that John Adams ever wrote was an attack on the Stamp Act. Now, when I was a kid, I had been taught that the Stamp Act was bad because it was an example of taxation without representation, which it was. But that is never mentioned in Adams's essay. Adams's essay is entirely about the circulation of knowledge. And he backs up and makes the claim that part of what the Puritan Revolution was about was freeing up knowledge from the old church and aristocratic controls that had governed it in Europe for centuries. And his thesis is that those controls were how the church and the crown kept the population in a state of staring timidity, as he says. So he reads the Stamp Act as a tax on knowledge. And it really is part of the early understanding that, again, if you want to have a self-governing nation where you have a population well enough educated to deliberate and debate and decide upon matters of public policy, then you not only need widespread education and free education, but you need very low barriers to the circulation of knowledge. And he read the Stamp Act as an attempt to inhibit this. And in fact, it was that. And there had been earlier cases in London where taxes on newspapers basically made them unaffordable to common people, and they became a luxury item. And it's a simple way to control how people get their news. You just tax the news. So, you know, one of the ways that my book is set up is in terms of how ownership is framed. You know, what is the story we tell about it? And the story commonly told now is that it's we do it to not only to incentivize, but to help people earn their living and help corporations earn their income and so forth, which is a good story. It's not that I disagree with that, but Adams would not have thought of it in those terms. He thought that the story that you have to tell around how you own or don't own ideas is the story of democracy.
Meaning that in terms of the democratic ideals that we have around ownership, that there would not be the concerns or there would not be as many barriers to the commons as we currently have or indeed have then. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, even as they were inventing the earliest copyright and patent regimes in the United States, the understanding always was that the simple truth that there's always a trade-off between public and private benefit. It's a bargain between the public good and the private good, and that ultimately the public good is the thing that's supposed to trump. If the private incentive grows too large, you begin to lose the public. And let me quote you one thing from a more recent Supreme Court decision. This is 1994, William Rehnquist, not a wild-eyed radical, writing in a copyright case. He says, "We have often recognized the monopoly privileges that Congress has authorized are limited in nature and most ultimately serve the public good." Now, that's the utilitarian view of these things, which is to say, A, they are monopoly privileges, and we do give them for some reasons, but finally, they have to be limited and they have to serve the public good. And so when you first get them in this country, the limit is 28 years maximum. So it's very clear that the public good is, you have a basically infinite public good after that, and you have a limited term private good to begin with. I call this the Republican two-step. That is to say, I'm interested in the fact that the founders were not at all against individual property and individual property rights. They thought they were very important, and very important to give citizens the kind of property that would give them freedom and give them a basis to become public actors. But the second part of this is the important part for them, that the public action, being able to enter the world and try to acquire what used to be called civic virtue, that's the point. The point is not the property. The property is there to give you a basis to become a public actor. And so first, individual private good, but then finally, something having to do with the public and the public good. That was the ethic, the civic Republican ethic.
We're chatting with Professor Lewis Hyde, author of the book Common as Air, coming out in paperback form on October 25th on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, you know, I could ask the pithy question, Lewis, which is how and when do we lose our way? But I'll ask a question a little more specifically. We see certainly given that we're entering or we're in a presidential race at this point, we we see constant references, particularly from the Republican Party, to the Founding Fathers, to the writings from the Federalist Papers and so forth. Your book does an excellent job of mining this history for a point which isn't as often made, which is this idea of this commons of the mind or cultural property being a shared resource. I'm curious to get your perspective on not a crystal ball question, but more where we are today in terms of our understanding of this rich history that we have. Do you think that there is a given our current political situation, a more hopeful narrative than one that we've seen thus far, that would allow perhaps for a at least beginning of a reconsideration of these issues without resort to courts, or indeed without resort to the laudable work of Professor Lessig in attempting to remove money from politics? Or is this something that is simply too abstract or too difficult to tie, to fight, given our current system?
It depends on the day and what my blood sugar level is. But let's try the hopeful narrative for at least a moment here. I think one of the great surprises of the internet and digital copying has been collaborative, commons-based knowledge production. I mean, Wikipedia and all these things are great examples. There's a long list of it. But and many people are interested in the commons as a concept and find it a useful tool for approaching some of the otherwise intractable problems we have. I'll give you just a brief list. I mean, there are here's one example. A man named Varmus, who won a Nobel Prize in chemistry, helped set up a thing called the Public Library of Science. Public Library of Science publishes scientific journals online for free, internationally distributed. The people who write and publish the articles give absolute rights to anybody to use them. The point is to spread, for example, medical knowledge to wherever it needs to go, rather than have scientific journals whose annual subscription rate is $1,000 a year, and therefore the knowledge never gets to poor countries or poor colleges. There's a long, long list of not just places where the commons has become of interest, but of people who've been able to take common property regimes and make them actually active. Another example is the movement known as Creative Commons, which happily works inside of current copyright law, but gives people a suite of licenses wherein they can release their work under terms that are more liberal than one normally thinks they can be. So I, for example, on my website, I have some old songs of mine. They're up there for free to anybody to sing or use or download. If you make a lot of money on them, you have to come talk to me. But other than that, they're just released because why not? So, and maybe the final thing to say is, I do believe in all of these things that the language we use and the frames within which we discuss them are well worth contending. And so one of the simple tasks of my book is to try to revive the idea that copyright and patent are monopoly privileges. These are not, well, to the degree that they are property right, they're a very special kind called a monopoly privilege. I'd like to see everybody use that phrase all the time as a way of describing this, because then it becomes clear that you're giving somebody something that they might not otherwise have, but there's always a danger to monopoly. So, I mean, the hope is we can change the terms and we can also build things that give us agency inside of a commons model.
Lewis, with regard to, and we have about, I'd say, 15 minutes at most left, maybe about 13, I do want to touch on secrecy, which you mentioned earlier and which is indeed an interest of mine. There's a fascinating story that you tell of a trade secret that Franklin held, which went with him to his grave. And what lessons from that story, perhaps you could just tell it, should we take about trade secrecy law and secrecy more broadly as we think about it today?
Yeah, so the the context that is of interest, and then I'll tell the story, is that, of course, before the 18th century, most craft knowledge was held by guilds, and guilds rightly kept their knowledge secret. That's how you kept your power as a guild master. So glassblowers and sword makers and printers and all these had tricks of the trade which belonged to them, and there were lots of strong normative rules about not sharing them outside of the guild because you would undermine your own market. Now, what happens in the 18th century is that guild secrecy begins to weaken and things become public knowledge. And in fact, one way to think about the rise of the patent privilege was that it was a way of breaking guild secrecy. That is to say, if you had a cunning invention as a optical lens maker in London, for example, you had a choice of whether to keep it secret inside the guild or give it to the public. And what patent did was to say, if you give it to the public, we will reward you by giving you a monopoly privilege for a certain amount of time. But the point is that the time has a limit so that it finally becomes public knowledge. So Benjamin Franklin, for example, invented bifocal glasses. Now, he wasn't interested in patenting, so it became public knowledge immediately. But somebody who had done that a century earlier might have, well, I guess once you've seen the bifocals, you know how to do them. But there were other tricks of the trade that were kept secret. Now, the one story about Franklin that's nicely juxtaposed with the rest of his practice is that he in Philadelphia was sometimes the printer of money for different colonies, New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And when you printed money in those days, to make it hard to counterfeit, you put on the back of it a thing called a nature print. You'd kind of take the impress of a leaf or something and print it on the back. And it became very, very difficult to copy this because it was a unique image. And the way that Franklin did this, we don't know, because it was a trade secret and he kept it as a trade secret. And when he died, it died. And there are interesting letters in which people say, well, he showed me how to do this, but I'm not going to tell you. That's how he makes his money. And it's a secrecy. But contrasted to that is Franklin was, in every other regard, more interested in public knowledge. And whenever he invented something, he announced it immediately to the public. He invented the lightning rod, and he immediately published in Poor Richard's Almanac and in a newspaper in Philadelphia clear instructions about how to make a lightning rod and how it worked and what it would do. It would be the kind of thing that you now have to write out to get a patent. Mm-hmm. Instructions so that anybody could do the same thing. But he just publishes it, and it becomes common knowledge.
The idea of secrecy, of course, is one that that pervades society and obviously beyond intellectual property to policymaking more broadly. Do you think ultimately that we have too many secrets? And I'll say that generally, if you want to fine-grain it from there.
Well, you probably have to take it on a case basis. I mean, I don't think that trade secrecy is a bad thing. I think many industries need it. I mean, the risk you take with a trade secret is that it could get out, and the thing you get with a patent is clear ownership. You don't lose your secret. You get to really own it. But yeah, we probably have too much secrecy. I'll tell you a story. Shortly after my book came out, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times about Alzheimer's research. Government and private industry and the academy are all trying to figure out how to make what are called biomarkers, ways to track, to predict when Alzheimer's may arise. And apparently about 10 or 15 years ago, people got together and said, you know, it's just not working. Everything we know is too siloed. We're not conversing with each other, so let's not do that anymore. There was a wonderful quote from one of the scientists. He said, we have to park our intellectual property egos outside the door. And they began to just simply share their knowledge. And the result was real advances in how to get biomarkers for Alzheimer's. So it's clear that in many cases, secrecy simply gums up the system. It produces what I call cultural aphasia. It's not that you can't finally think about it someday, but everything gets so slowed down that we can't move forward.
We're chatting with Professor Lewis Hyde, author of the book Common as Air on Hearsay Culture and KZSU. Lewis, we have about 7 minutes left. I do want to ask you another interesting set of stories that you tell involve piracy, and particularly Franklin's views on piracy. What are they, and is that a useful view for today?
Well, you know, piracy is always defined in different contexts, and to do the Franklin one, the two things that interest me about Franklin and piracy, one is when he was a kid, he was apprenticed to his brother, a printer in Boston. He and his brother argued, and Franklin didn't get along. And Franklin fled and went to Philadelphia and became a printer. But the interesting detail in the autobiography, as he's fleeing, as he makes the trip from Boston to Philadelphia, he's very much afraid he'll be arrested as a runaway apprentice. Now, in fact, he was a runaway apprentice, and he could have been arrested because what he was doing was illegal. He was taking the trade secrets that printers were slowly teaching him and leaving town with them. And so I call this a foundational act of piracy. When I ask my students about it, none of them feel that Franklin did anything wrong. They all love the story of him running away. So then click forward 70 years, and we find Franklin in France as a diplomat after the revolution, representing the United States. People keep coming to him and asking to emigrate to the United States and bring trade knowledge with them. And he always supports them. An example is some calico printers from London come to Franklin and say, we'd like to get to Philadelphia and set up a calico printing shop. And he encourages them to do it and helps them out in different ways. But the point here is two things. One is, well, the main one is that what they were doing was also technically piracy, that England and other European countries had anti-immigration laws that were meant to protect industrial knowledge that was proprietary to the country. So, and Franklin's line on this was, when you inhibit the motion of people like this, you're simply inhibiting ideas from moving around. And he believed in the free flow of people and the free flow of ideas. And so, in a certain sense, Franklin was a pirate. And the final detail on this maybe is, if you read the very first copyright law that was written in the United States, it's 1790, it has in it what I call the piracy clause. It's a clause that says this law does not apply to anybody except a U.S. citizen, which meant that for the first 100 years, the United States was a pirate nation. We printed books that came out of Europe without paying a nickel to the people who made them. And, you know, this was argued as a benefit to the United States. We are a nation of readers. We want to circulate books. We're not going to, you know, inhibit ourselves by worrying about the laws of foreign nations. So in all these ways, from today's point of view, the United States at the end of Franklin's life was a happily pirate nation.
You know, Lewis, I think, and as we have a few minutes left, I think that last point ties into another phrase that you use in a book that I'd like you to define, which is cultural aphasia. And I'll ask you what that is, and then how can we avoid it?
Well, so aphasia, technically, as a medical term, is a mind impairment where you cannot recall things to mind, but also cannot speak very well. So it's a very slowing down of the mind. But, you know, a lot of times in intellectual property debates, people say, well, listen, yeah, we have copyright laws and people get ownership maybe for 95 or 100 years now, but we have these stopgap, we have these guarantors of the First Amendment called fair use and the idea, expression, dichotomy, and so forth. And you can always write and get permission to use something if you want to use it. Now, this is all true. But the fact is that it slows everything down. A good case in point is the James Joyce estate has been very antagonistic towards scholars and has refused permissions and finally got beaten back under a fair use claim. But in fact, it took years to do, and it took $250,000 to do. So you could say, yes, you can... you're free to use James Joyce's work in a fair use fashion. However, you can't do it unless you wait 2 years and have $250,000. So there are ways in which we've tried to have escape hatches to the ways that copyright inhibits discourse. But what they really do is to slow things down. And the permissions problem is even worse. I mean, you know, libraries which have collections of old pamphlets and try to put them up online, they just can't get the permissions. They can't find the owners. And if they do get the owners, they take 2 months to get the permission, and often they just don't respond. So the system is slowed down by our current set of rules, and I call this cultural aphasia.
And I should mention that the case, the Schloss case, which dealt directly with the James Joyce estates and their use of copyright, was handled primarily by my former colleague fellow at the Center for Society, David Olson, who now teaches at Boston College. And it was something that CIS represented the plaintiff, Professor Schloss, in that case, by way of disclaimer and disclosure. As we close the discussion, Lewis, perhaps I'll ask you this pie-in-the-sky question, but I think I debated whether I should ask it, but I think I'm going to. Given this history and given your views, I'll give you the proverbial magic wand, and I'll say you could change one aspect of our understanding of intellectual property and one aspect of the law in order to affect the changes. What would that change be? What would you do to the law and to our understanding of intellectual property to get us to a true view of the commons as common as air?
Well, I'm going to give you two short answers. One is the magic wand in which I can really change anything, and the other is the more practical magic wand.
Right.
We would do something which might happen. I mean, a simple thing to do is to go back to something closer to the founders' sense of the limit of the term of ownership. And a simple suggestion would be to let copyright run the life of the author, or 50 years, whichever one is longer. That would be a term longer than the founders had, but I think it's a fair term, and it would just mean that we don't have this kind of infinite copyright regime that we have now. But I don't think that's going to happen. The people who would benefit from it are too thinly spread, and the people who would lose something are too powerful. The thing that practically might be done, and I have an afterword about this in the new paperback coming out of Common as Air, and it's also an essay on the Chronicle of Higher Education has this in a current issue, and that is to bring back the formalities of copyright. It used to be you had to register your copyright to get the full suite of rights. You had to pay a little fee. You had to deposit a copy. You had to print a notice, and we used to divide the term up into several shorter terms, and you had to apply for a renewal. And what all these things did was to basically ask people to make a decision. Does it matter to you to own this? If so, you can have the ownership, but you have to opt in. You can't just have it by default, which is what we now have. There are many ways in which, if we brought back formalities which have been lost, the system would be more in accord with the founders' vision.
Professor Lewis Hyde, author of the book Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership, joining us today on Hearsay Culture on KZSU. Lewis, thank you for joining us today on the show. For those people that want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
Well, again, Common as Air is just coming out in some paperback, and so you can get it more cheaply. You can also get it from your local library. There's a Kindle edition, and several chapters of it are available on the web in various forms, and there are also some talks I gave at the Berkman Center on YouTube. So look around. And I have a website that's lewishyde.com. My name is spelled LewisHyde, lewishyde.com. And if you browse around in there, you'll see where to go for other things.
Lewis, thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to future discussions. But this is terrific, and I look forward to chatting with you again in the future.
Thank you.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests upcoming for the rest of the quarter on KZSU's schedule. Among them, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, Baron Zoka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade, Professor Ethan Lieb of UC Hastings College of Law, author of Friend vs. Friend, Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing privacy in context. Dean Saul Levmore and Professor Martha Nussbaum of the University of Chicago Law School, co-editors of The Offensive Internet, Speech, Privacy, and Reputation. And rounding out this quarter, Professor George Contreras of American University Washington College of Law. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The main way is live Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU FM Stanford, which you can also stream live at KZSULive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by podcast, either by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous shows, upcoming schedule, and so forth. You can get the show by subscribing to the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, that's CIS's website, or indeed Hearsay Culture's RSS feed. And you can also get the show directly via iTunes by going to the Center for Internet Society's page in the iTunes search engine. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback, ruminations, thoughts, at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.